If you look at China's, one of the policies that China introduced a couple of years ago was called the dual circulation economic policy. They always have these rather difficult to understand slogans and names for things. So what does dual circulation mean? Well, what it means is they think of China as having sort of being a fluid economy where there are two circulations or circles. So one is external circulation. That means trade and investment with the rest of the world, right? But then there's internal circulation, which is the domestic economy, right? And so essentially what they've said in dual circulation is, yeah, we need trade and investment with the rest of the world, but we also recognize that that's becoming more complicated because the U.S. is hostile and we have all these challenges. So we need to focus more on developing the domestic economy.
So counting on the big,
on the big domestic market. And the other way that they have sort of characterized this is they want to make other countries more dependent on the China market, and they want China to become less dependent on the rest of the world.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by Arthur Kreber, who is the partner and head of research at GavCal, a Hong Kong-based financial service firm, and the founder of the China-focused GavCal Dragonomics Research Service. Before establishing Dragonomics in 2002, he spent 15 years as a financial and economic journalist in China and Southeast Asia. And this is a podcast in my Nobel Symposium series this summer on politics and economics in China and Southeast Asia. Today we're going to talk about China's economic performance and the long-term economic outlook. We will also include comments on the China-US relations and the implications of the Russian-Ukraine war for China. Welcome and thank you for joining me today, Arthur.
I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
Can you just take us through the Chinese economic growth and performance the past decades? I mean, since 1978, precisely. And in your paper for the Nobel Symposium, you have an interesting summary of the composition of the Chinese GDP growth. We can do that afterwards. But first, the general decades development.
Well, the general picture is that in the late 1970s, Deng Xiaoping, who was the leader of China at that time, initiated a program of what he called reform and opening. And the basic idea was to introduce more market mechanisms in the Chinese economy, which up until that time had been centrally planned, and also open it to the outside world and have more of a focus on inviting foreign investment and creating exports. And over the succeeding decades, this program and its subsequent developments delivered one of the best growth records that any economy has ever experienced. China grew by over 10% a year for more than 30 years until about 2012. And even after that, continued at a pace of around 6 or 7% for the next decade or so. Hundreds of millions of people were raised out of poverty. China went from being an isolated pariah state to one that was tightly integrated in the world economy and most global institutions. It became the world's second biggest economy, the biggest manufacturer, the biggest trading nation. So in economic terms, this focus on more markets and more openness to the outside world really paid spectacular dividends. Mm.
And you also have this very interesting summary of the composition of Chinese GDP growth, because over the same time span, that has been changing.
Right. So there are a couple of different ways that you can look at this. One is that a lot of the growth in the 80s and 90s came simply from loosening the restrictions that had existed on private enterprises, promoting exports and so forth. Then in the late 1990s, partly in response to a major financial crisis that swept across Asia, growth slowed and they started investing quite heavily in infrastructure. So expressways, airports, rail networks, ports, all kinds of things, telecoms and electricity networks. And that was really necessary because China was a very underdeveloped country, even in the late 1990s in terms of its infrastructure. The other thing that they did at that time was they privatized the urban housing market. And so for the first time, people were able to buy their own homes. And this sparked probably the biggest housing boom in human history. So the result of this is that after about 2000, a very large proportion of China's growth came from these massive investments in infrastructure and in housing, which facilitated all kinds of new parts of the economy, consumer services, and so forth. But the driving force, a lot of it, was infrastructure and housing. And what became evident after the global financial crisis of 2008, when again they did an even larger sort of focus on infrastructure to support growth in uncertain times, was that you began to lose productivity growth. So productivity growth was extremely high, and this just means how much economic output you are able to generate per person working in the economy. Productivity was extremely high in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. But since the global financial crisis in 2008, what has happened is that China's continued to grow and grow quite strongly, but the contribution of productivity growth has shrunk, and the contribution of pure capital spending on infrastructure and housing has increased. And so now China is at a turning point where it can't generate the same amount of growth as it has in the past from infrastructure and housing because it's now built out a modern state. And so they need to do something to get productivity up.
Yeah, and the question is, of course, what and how.
Yes, indeed.
But in recent years, concerns about China have risen, and you mentioned like three things. You mentioned China's state-directed economy undermines a sense of fair competition. And second, China could use its growing economic influence to export its authoritarian model of governance. And finally, China's economic and political and technological cloth could undermine the U.S. leadership.
Right.
So those are three different concerns that are mentioned internationally. Can you elaborate a bit what you mean by these three?
So I think China is obviously a very interesting case because it's had this spectacular economic growth. As I mentioned, it has integrated into global economic institutions. It's a very competitive exporter. And for quite a while, I think most people in the developed world viewed this just as a positive development. Incomes were rising. China was becoming more of a market. It was very efficient to move production of many goods from high-cost regions in Europe, North America, or Asia into China. So it kind of was highly beneficial for everyone. And then, you know, I think what has happened in the last decade or so is that as China has become, number one, more directly competitive with the advanced economies in terms of the kinds of goods that it can produce, and it has not undergone the kind of political change that many people expected when they embarked on this market capitalist experiment. People, in particularly in the United States and increasingly in Europe, have become more and more uncomfortable with China's role. And as you suggested there, there are several sources of this discomfort. In the economic realm, there's a lot of complaints about the fact that China's state still has a very large role in the economy. You know, state enterprises account for about 25 to 30% of economic output. There's no other country in the world where that number is more than about 5 or 6%. So China's a real outlier there. China also, the state owns all of the banks and the financial institutions, so it's able to direct resources in a way that no other economy can. So it can provide subsidies to favored companies. And so there are concerns that because China has this large state role and because China is so huge, that this upsets the competitive fairness of the global economy because other states are not able to subsidize their companies to the same degree that China does. So that's one set of concerns. And then, you know, another set of concerns has to do with the fact that China has an authoritarian political system built on very different values than is the case in, again, North America, Europe, and in fact, much of the advanced Asian economy is also countries that are basically democratic. And the rules of the global economic system via the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank and these other institutions were essentially built around the assumption that most economies participating, certainly the big ones, would be market-oriented, not state-run, and that they would share certain norms of modern liberal democratic societies, even across a very wide range. And China just doesn't fit, and it does not seem to be becoming more of a good fit with this economy, with these premises of the global system. And then I think there's a straight-up power dynamic that the United States has been the leading power in the world, you know, unambiguously since the end of the Cold War in 1990. And China is an independent geopolitical actor with its own ambitions, not part of the U.S. alliance or security network, and, you know, basically not viewed as friendly in the United States. So in addition to these sort of more general concerns about the nature of the economy and the role of the state, you have a straight-up power competition between the U.S. and China. And so the result is we're now, I think, in a very difficult situation where China continues to grow. It faces some real challenges in sustaining that growth in the coming decades. But it's still, every year, it's playing a larger role in the global economy. But its political system and the way that it organizes itself is very, very different than most other incumbents in the global system organize themselves. So there's a lot more friction now than there used to be, you know, 10 or 15 years ago.
Yes, and we can also say that politically, China has really gone more in an authoritarian direction than before. So that's another development in another direction.
Yeah, and that's an important point. For many years, China had a regular rotation where every 10 years you would get a new leader. So it was authoritarian, but there was a rotation of power. And Xi Jinping, the current president, 5 years ago, changed the constitution so that he can essentially stay in power forever. And I think that has changed, you know, the opinion of where China is headed, you know, in many places. Mm.
So you mentioned also that there are things, a couple of things that might have implications for China's future development. Among them are aging population and debts and investments going from business to housing and infrastructure. So we can start with the first component, that is the aging population.
Right.
What can that lead to for China?
Well, there's a fair amount of debate about this because there's no question that China has benefited over the last 40 years from having a relatively young population with a lot of people of working age, not too many retirees that had to be taken care of with expensive pensions and healthcare and so forth. And, you know, I think China was, it is not the case that every country with a young population will have spectacular economic growth. You still have to have the right policies. But China did a very good job of harnessing its young workforce to generate high growth rates. And now they're facing the opposite problem, which is the population is aging very quickly. In about 25 years, by most projections, the average age in China will be older than it is in Japan today.
That's old.
And we all know that Japan is a relatively old society, and a lot of people think that some of Japan's growth struggles in recent decades have come from the fact that it's been an aging society. So it's a real challenge. But there are things that can be done to offset it. So for example, on average, people stop working in China at a very early age, often in their 50s. This has to do both with sort of official retirement rules in the state sector, but also with the structure of the economy. As they become more of a service-oriented economy where the jobs are physically less taxing, people can work longer, and they can also do some policy things to encourage people to stay in the workforce longer. So some of the aging population can be offset by extending people's working lives, not to an unusual level. If you can get the average person in China to work until they're 65 or so, which is standard in most modern economies, that would be a significant extension of the average career in China today. Mm. So demographics is not destiny. There are definitely some challenges. Pensions will become more expensive. Healthcare will become more expensive. And the state will have to figure out how to manage those expenses. But I think there's no doubt that the aging population will, on average, tend to slow down China's rate of growth. It's the question is like, how much?
Yeah.
And policy can, I think, make some significant differences.
There will still be growth, but it will be much smaller than it has been.
It will certainly be smaller, but how much slower, I think, will depend less on the population trends and more on the policies.
Okay. So, and what about debts? Because you have also written about that in your paper, and that's interesting because we don't usually hear so much about that in the West.
Right.
So what are your points?
Well, so in the sort of the financial world, people have been paying a lot of attention to Chinese debt for a long time. It's risen very quickly, especially since the global financial crisis of 2008. And if you look at total debt in the economy relative to the size of GDP, it's about 270-280%. And that is, frankly, pretty normal for an advanced society like most European countries, the US, Japan is even higher. So if China was as rich as the advanced economies, its debt level would be not unusual. But if you compare China to other countries with about the same level of income, Brazil, Russia, their debt level is very high. So they have a debt level that is not necessarily high in absolute terms, but is high relative to where they are in their development trajectory. Mm. And a lot of the reason for this is that they have invested very heavily in infrastructure, and a lot of this infrastructure is very expensive to build. And so they've relied on debt. So that's okay. But now, essentially, they have to figure out a way to grow without investing so much in infrastructure and without piling on all of this debt. Mm. And they're struggling. The government has been trying for 5 years to constrain the level of debt growth and make sure that debt and the economy grow at essentially the same pace. And this becomes problematic. For example, this year they've had a slowdown. They want to stimulate the economy, but they can't stimulate too much by simply easing credit the way a central bank normally would, because they're worried about the debt ratio getting too high. So some people have looked at the debt level and said, well, China's very close to a financial crisis. I don't agree with that, but I do agree, and I think most serious analysts would agree, that the high debt level is now a constraint on policy. So China, there's various things that they can do to stimulate growth. But one thing that they can't do too much of is simply to pump more debt into the economy. So they have limited room for maneuver in that particular dimension.
Mm. Are there other concerns you think that we should be aware of when it comes to, you mentioned something from, well, the investments going from businesses to housing and infrastructure?
Yeah, so the main thing that I think a lot of people are focusing on now is that, as I mentioned before, China has gotten an enormous proportion of its economic growth, you know, maybe 70 or 80% of its economic growth over the last decade has come essentially from investments in big capital projects. And, you know, when China had no roads, if you built a road, that generated a huge amount of economic activity. So in the early days, these investments in infrastructure were very, very productive.
Booming, yeah.
Right, because they would spur all kinds of other activities, right? But once you have a expressway system that is half again as large as the United States interstate highway system, there's a road to everywhere. You build another road, it doesn't create any new activity. Mm. And this is where China is today, that they've basically built all the infrastructure that they need for a modern economy. So building more infrastructure will deliver no return. So if you want to get economic growth, you have to focus your investments in areas that will generate a return and generate productivity growth. And productivity growth has been quite weak for the last decade. Now, it's worth mentioning that productivity growth has slowed in every country in the world. So this is not just a China problem. This appears to be a global problem that we don't entirely understand. But if you look at China's specific case, it's clear that whatever is causing the global productivity slowdown, in addition to that, you have some things that are particular to China, that they've relied very heavily on these infrastructure investments. They're not generating much growth now, and so you have to shift to a different way of managing the economy that focuses on delivering high productivity growth. And old habits are hard to change. China has been doing things in a certain way for a very long time and has built up a lot of institutions around that. And so it's like trying to, you know, change the direction of a giant aircraft carrier. It doesn't happen very quickly.
Just out of curiosity, how do you see or how do you evaluate the quality of these infrastructure? I mean, the quality of the buildings, the quality of everything in China.
It's quite high. Yeah. So if you go and, for example, ride on the high-speed rail network, it's, you know, pretty much world standard. The expressways that they built are very good. The port system that they have is, again, first rate. And this is what helps support their position in global trade, is that they have, you know, 10 or 20 really world-class ports there. So the issue is not that they've built a lot of infrastructure that doesn't work very well. The quality has been extremely high. The problem is they now have enough. They don't need to build any more of that, and they need to focus on the things at the business level that will sort of spur innovation, enable more creativity, enable businesses to respond more effectively to consumer demand, and harness technology in ways that delivers goods and services that people want.
So that brings me up, improving
the market system in China, which is, that's a piece of the infrastructure that works well in some areas and not so well in other areas.
Because that's my next question, really. You have you mentioned that China has launched a technology strategy in order to maybe meet some of these problems. And it's something that you have called venture capital state.
Right.
And, do you think, first, what is this? And in the long run, do you think that this strategy here will succeed for China in boosting, like we have said now, productivity and investing things in high tech, which is part of this technology strategy?
Yeah, okay. So I think maybe one way to address this is to talk about what a lot of economists say China should do, on the one hand, and then talk about what China is actually doing, because they're a little bit different, right? So a lot of economists have been saying for many years, and this is not just Western economists, there are plenty of economists within China who've been making similar arguments, that China has been very investment-focused, and that was fine, but now it needs to shift to being more like a European or North American economy where really consumer demand drives the economy. And the idea here is that it's really in responding to consumer demand that companies figure out how to innovate and create, you know, productivity and growth, right? The Chinese government basically disagrees with this, and they say, no, growth comes from investment, right? But we have to invest in the right things.
And they have to choose?
Yes. So, and the state has a role in sort of deciding where the investment goes. So in the past, we invested in infrastructure and housing. That was appropriate for that time. And we recognize that that is now, you know, pretty much complete. So now it's the job of the government to figure out the next investment program. And what they have decided is that instead of investing in, you know, traditional infrastructure, they're going to invest in high technology industries. And this is defined very broadly. So it can be semiconductors or robotics or artificial intelligence or biotechnology or aerospace, you name it. They have a plan to invest heavily in these areas. And the economic thinking is basically like, If you invest in these high technology areas and you're successful, you'll create competitive companies that will be able to employ a lot of people, pay them very high wages, and then you will get a lot of consumer activity as a result of the high-paying jobs and the income that's created by these technology-intensive industries. So they're not saying that consumer activity is, you know, pointless or that you should ignore it, but they're just saying that the order in which these things come is different, that you do the investments first, and then that will create a more vibrant consumer economy. And the reason I call it a venture capital state is this is not just central planning. It's not the government saying, okay, we're going to take $100 billion of government funds and we're going to invest it in all of these different things. What the government does is they act like a giant venture capital fund, and they say, okay, in our portfolio, we want these sectors that we think are going to be very important in the future, and we'll put some government money into these. But what we really want is private companies or foreign companies or the capital markets in China or overseas to agree with this, that these are, you know, high growth sectors of the future. And we want to sort of incentivize those other funders to come in. And then we'll see how things work out, and some companies will succeed and other companies will fail. But overall, you know, over the course of decades, we'll build successful industries. So the government is, instead of acting like a central planner, they're acting more as a venture capitalist would say. We identify the big opportunities, we go to other investors, we get them in, and we let the companies do their thing. And, you know, hopefully if we made the right bets, not all of them will succeed, but enough of them will succeed that, you know, we wind up with a much more advanced economy. You know, and other countries in Asia have done sort of similar things, but no one's done it as systematically or on the scale that China has. So it's an interesting giant experiment. And I think the critique that I would have of this is it's not necessarily the case that a technology producer, like a semiconductor fab or whatever, will magically produce productivity growth, right? It may produce a lot of high technology goods, but ultimately the economic growth comes from people figuring out how to use those products in ways to better deliver goods and services to consumers. So I think the big question mark sitting around China's development strategy is, okay, they're going to be successful at creating a lot of production of technology goods. I think that's quite clear. But will that production then translate into actual productivity growth throughout the economy that raises everyone's incomes? Or does it just benefit the relatively small number of workers who happen to be working in the semiconductor fab or in that production? And I think that's very questionable, frankly.
Yeah, I think I can agree. Absolutely. Because, I mean, this technology strategy here is in a country that's authoritarian and has a central structure. And as you say, normally in any country that will be a liberal democracy, for instance, you will start this bottom up and not like it will be the demands. Right.
One thing I would just add to that is that I think what's interesting about China is that if you look at it historically over the last 40 years, it's actually been very successful at combining the advantages of an authoritarian state with bottom-up entrepreneurship. So even though it's not democratic, private companies are very vibrant. You know, they make up, you know, probably 3/4 of economic output. They continue to grow. They're very dynamic. They're very creative. So despite the fact that it's an authoritarian space, a lot of room has been left for bottom-up activity. And that makes China very unusual because most authoritarian states aren't able to pull that off. So if they need to build a high-speed rail network, some giant infrastructure project, the authoritarian top-down benefit comes because they can mobilize capital for that. But they've also left a lot of space for the private entrepreneurs. And I think the question that a lot of people have right now, which we don't know the answer to, is maybe there's too much emphasis now on the top-down part of the equation, and the space for the bottom-up stuff is is possibly shrinking. There's debate about that, and the data is ambiguous, but there's certainly, I think, a lot of concerns. And if that really does happen, then I think that's going to be bad for China's growth, because they need the bottom-up stuff.
Yeah, because my question then was, mentioned a crackdown on technology firms, and I just put in a question mark about Jack Ma, for instance. Yep. And with that question mark, my question was actually when some of these very successful private companies become too big and too important in this sector, China can do, or the authorities can do whatever they like.
Right.
And I mean, to any entrepreneur or successful entrepreneur, I mean, in the US or anywhere, would not like the government to interfere or even remove people. So, can you be sure that won't happen in the future as well? Or is it still that kind of system?
It's a very good question. I think it's a little complicated, though. So Jack Ma is the founder of Alibaba, the biggest e-commerce company in China that had gradually moved into all kinds of other activities, including financial services. And China has had a very vibrant internet sector. And because its internet is closed off from the rest of the world, they didn't have Facebook or Google or whatever, Amazon. So they had their own companies, which were enormous and were subject in China to exactly the same criticisms that Facebook and Google and Amazon are subject to in the United States and Europe. They're monopolies. They crowd out innovation by smaller companies. They scoop up people's private data and use it for their own ends and create all kinds of social problems. And because Alibaba, through its Ant financial subsidiary, was going into finance, there was a real concern that they were going to create massive financial risk of the same type that was created in the United States before the financial crisis of 2008. If you look at their business model, it was pretty similar to a lot of the bad things that were being done in the United States in 2005, 6, 7, right? So I think the context of this, you can look at the crackdown on Jack Ma and these other internet companies as the state getting paranoid that these private companies are getting too big and too powerful, right? And there's certainly plenty of private entrepreneurs in China that have drawn that lesson. It's like, don't want to get too big, otherwise we'll get in trouble. But I think you can look at this and also say the Chinese government is basically just trying to deal with the same problems that the European regulators and the US regulators are trying to deal with, but they're more effective because they're an authoritarian state and they can just do it. So I think the point is both things are true at the same time. There was a legitimate need, I think, to regulate these companies and their use of data and their monopoly power, and particularly their capacity to create financial risk. Those are real things. Any government, I think, would be legitimately concerned about those problems. China being China, not only did they have this legitimate concern, they acted very aggressively and maybe in a ham-handed way, right? So that is true. But it is also true that there is a lesson there for private companies that maybe their space to operate is constricted. On the other hand, if you look at the comprehensive data on private sector, the private sector in China continues to grow. Its share of most indicators continues to grow. Most private companies are not in the internet. They're operating in, you know, hardware and, you know, various other things or small-scale consumer services. They're doing fine. So it's a complicated equation where the private sector continues to be a very big part of the Chinese economy. In certain zones, it has clearly been reined back in. And maybe that will cause entrepreneurs to be less, you know, creative in future, but maybe not. So I think it's, we have a lot of evidence that moves in different directions.
Could you also comment a bit on the US-China relations and when it comes to especially finance and technology, because technology here is an important factor, and also how this rivalry is about to develop in the future?
Yeah, well, I think you can, I think, boil this down fairly straightforwardly. So basically what happened was that in 2013, Xi Jinping took over China, and he decided, among other things, that he was going to be much more aggressive and assertive about giving China a global role. He did things that, you know, to some extent make sense from China's own desires to become a great power again, but were also viewed, particularly by the United States, as somewhat disruptive to the global system. So that was one thing that happened. And then I think the other thing that happened was that, you know, the United States went through, you know, its own major political transition in 2016. And there are a lot of people in the U.S., as there are in other countries, who felt that the whole trend of globalization of the last 40 years, of which China's rise is a symbol, did not benefit them, and they were left behind. And so there was a lot of anger about this. And there was also, I think, a sense among American elites that China was, you know, just becoming too powerful in too many different ways, and that this was threatening to American power. And so the result was that starting with the Trump administration, we had a change in the basic view that the United States had of China. For the previous 30 years, it was complicated, but fundamentally the U.S. felt that it was beneficial for China to grow economically, and it was beneficial for the U.S. to have a high degree of engagement with China and interdependence. And this is now over, and the relationship is viewed in the United States as purely competitive. And what's interesting is that we had a change of administrations. President Biden came in, different party, very different perspective than President Trump in many ways, but he essentially maintained the China policy without any changes whatsoever. So we now have both the Republicans and the Democrats have basically said, okay, this is the policy towards China. It is about competition. And I think what you're seeing is efforts in the U.S. to restrict the flows of technology and finance from an investment from the U.S. to China, because China is now seen as a rival and a competitor. So after decades where basically we encouraged flows between the two countries, now the basic policy in the U.S. is to find ways that we can restrict those flows. And, you know, I think this is just a fact of life. But I think the challenge in the United States, and you see this also in Europe, is on the one hand, there are concerns about China's role as an authoritarian state, you know, what that could mean for the global system, you know, economic competition from Chinese companies. All of these things are problematic. And so I think there are efforts to, especially in the United States, but also in Europe, to try and safeguard national security. But they run up against the fact that the economic relationship is still very positive, and most companies, large companies, view China as an integral part of their global strategy. It's a huge market. It's a very efficient production base. And increasingly, if you want to be on the front lines of innovation in many sectors, you have to have a presence in China. So international companies say, you know, we have to be in China. We have to keep investing there for all of these different reasons. And the governments are saying, well, we wish you would invest less, or, you know, move your investment somewhere else. And the companies say, well, that's very difficult. So there's a tension now between the political national security concerns of the United States and other advanced government countries' governments, on the one hand, and the commercial interests. Mm. And it's not, they're to some degree in conflict. I think that conflict is just going to be a permanent feature of the next 10 to 20 years. And so it will be a sort of a tug of war between these two different sets of interests. And that will rearrange the economic relationships between China and the rest of the world. It won't cause them to end. It will just, the pieces will move around in a different way.
Yeah, and then that brings us over to, I mean, as I started with, the implications of the Russian-Ukraine war, right. and also for China, what these things, how this inflicts China, and the reasons for China's alignment with Russia. And then right. said, that said, we know that the size of the Russian economy is nothing compared to right. China. So right. What are your views on this in this situation,
well,
China?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing. So there are people who've pointed out, including people inside China, they say 3% of China's trade is with Russia. Something like 65% of China's trade is with the US, Europe, Japan, South Korea, Australia, these countries that have put sanctions on Russia. So why is China aligning with Russia? This makes no economic sense because our future really depends on economic engagement with the wider world. And Russia is just kind of a problem. But I think if you step back and look at how Xi Jinping and his colleagues are looking at this strategically, you have a different perspective. And the way that he looks at it is, number one, he's come to the conclusion that the United States, after many years of being basically supportive of China's growth, is now hostile. And so is engaged in an effort to try and contain China's growth and influence. And I think he's correct about that. I think that's very clear. So that's a problem that if you're the Chinese leader, you have to deal with. And then the second conclusion that he and his colleagues have come to is that the US is in decline. And I think he's wrong about that. But they believe that. And so if you believe that, number one, the US and its allies are hostile, but also that they represent a declining system and that the Chinese system is more efficient and more effective, then it's pretty natural to find other partners who sort of have the same worldview as you in terms of how society should be run. And Vladimir Putin, Russia, has a pretty similar worldview about the value of authoritarian rule. And the economies are also very complementary. I mean, Russia has enormous natural resources. China benefits to some degree, but actually the large majority of Russia's exports of natural resources do not go to China. They go to Europe and other countries. So China has a lot to gain by encouraging Russia to divert its natural resource exports more towards China. China needs those natural resources, oil, gas, metals, and so forth, to power its development. So there's a real complementarity there. And the reality is, from China's perspective, because Russia is so much smaller economically than China, it is guaranteed to be a junior partner. Yeah. So it's safe in that sense. So from that perspective, there's, I think, a very strong logic to why President Xi has decided to align China with Russia. He's been very careful about it. So he has ostensibly taken a neutral position in the Russia-Ukraine war. And China and its companies are complying with U.S. sanctions. So they're not violating their sanctions. They're not providing military equipment to the Russians. They're not providing technology. They're not providing finance. So he's navigating a very careful channel where fundamentally, there's a strong strategic alignment between China and Russia. But in this particular conflict, he's presenting a neutral face and he's not doing anything that would cause China to be the subject of sanctions. And so I think what that shows is that he's playing a very long game where this relationship with Russia is very important, but it also has to be balanced with China's very big economic engagements with the rest of the world.
Yeah, that was my follow-up question because, as you said, if 65% of exports goes, if that goes to all these countries that you mentioned
right.
that are sanctioning now
right.
Russia,
that's right.
China cannot live without an extensive export to countries and they need buyers for
yes.
their products. So how can they find other equally strong buyers globally?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is if you look at China's, one of the policies that China introduced a couple of years ago was called the dual circulation economic policy. They always have these rather difficult to understand slogans and names for things. So what does dual circulation mean? Well, what it means is they think of China as having sort of being a fluid economy where there are two circulations or circles. So one is external circulation. That means trade and investment with the rest of the world, right? But then there's internal circulation, which is the domestic economy, right? And so essentially what they've said in dual circulation is, yeah, we need trade and investment with the rest of the world, but we also recognize that that's becoming more complicated because the U.S. is hostile and we have all these challenges. So we need to focus more on developing the domestic economy.
So counting as a balance.
The big domestic market. And the other way that they have sort of characterized this is they want to make other countries more dependent on the China market. And they want China to become less dependent on the rest of the world, right? That's their theory. And so the idea is invite more foreign investment and have more foreign companies come in and to rely on the China market. And the logic there geopolitically is if you have tons and tons of foreign companies that really depend on the China market for a big part of their business, those companies will go to their governments and say, well, you can't be too mean to China and you shouldn't start a war with China and you can't cut them off because then we will make a lot less money, right? But at the same time, there's this effort to make China more self-sufficient so they don't have to rely on imports of technology from, you know, the United States and its allies and so forth. You know, frankly, I think this is a little simplistic and it sort of it just ignores the way that the global economy actually works, which is that dependency always flows both ways. It's a fantasy for China or anyone else, for that matter, including the United States, to make itself independent of the rest of the world. But I think that's their theory, that they are going to figure out a way to continue getting other people to buy their stuff, continue making other countries dependent on the China market, but somehow making China independent so it can do whatever it wants. Right? That's their theory. I don't think it's going to work, but that's where they're going. And the reality is that, you know, people buy Chinese stuff that's made in China because China is a very efficient place to make stuff. And if you're Apple or whatever, you can try to move your production chain out of China to India or Indonesia or Vietnam, but it's actually quite hard, right? Because you can do stuff in China that can't be done anywhere else. So I think, you know, my summary of this is that you have a lot of people throughout the world in different countries who have grown very uncomfortable with all of this interdependency that's grown up over the last 40 years. And they're saying, oh, this is not safe, this is problematic. And some of the problems are real. And so now you have movements in China, in the United States, everywhere else to say, oh, maybe we should be less dependent, we should produce more ourselves, et cetera. And that's gonna be very hard because the reasons for that interdependence are very powerful. Production chains are now very much embedded in different countries. And I think every country, including China, is going to find that it's very, very, very difficult to gain the kind of so-called independence from foreign influence that they would like to achieve.
Hmm. Yeah, a final small question that you can answer really briefly if you wish is if China would have to choose between Russia and the rest of the world, what will they do?
Well, they're trying very hard not to make that choice, right? Yeah. And this is precisely, if you look at what they're doing now, they've said, well, we have this great friendship with Russia. It's very important, but it's not so important that we're just going to like sever our commercial ties with the rest of the world. Those are too important too. So I think this is the thing, is that people can create fantasies about, oh, we choose one side or the other side and we reject these other people that we don't like. But the world is too complicated. You just can't make those simple choices. And, you know, I think one of the themes of this conference in reading through some of the papers is that, you know, people are saying, well, how close are we to replicating the Cold War situation where there really were two very different blocks There was no economic interchange between the Soviet bloc and the Western bloc. And countries really did have to choose which side are you on, right? Not everyone did, but most countries lined up. And I think the conclusion of most of the people who've studied this is that this is going to be a very complicated situation, but it's going to be different because no one wants to choose. And no one really has the power to force people to choose one side or the other. The connections are already too deep. So whatever kind of world we're going into, and it's a very complex and, you know, in some ways dangerous world, it's not going to be a Cold War world. It's going to be something else, something difficult, but it's not going to be these distinct camps. No one is going to be forced to choose completely one side or the other. And that includes China and that includes the United States. They're still bound together in many complicated ways.
Thank you so much, Arthur, because this is exactly the theme for another podcast in this series about the Cold War and how we could, how it's different today. So to do a little publicity for this series of Nobel.
Very good.
Yeah, Nobel. Yeah. You didn't know, but you did. So thanks a lot. You'll just tune in to Liberal Halvtime and listen to Odd Arne Westad, for instance, who is talking about these things. But thank you so much for your time today, Arthur.
Okay, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you. And for you, the listeners, if you like Liberal Halvtime, rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage, www.civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.